You're listening to New Hampshire Now.
Welcome back here on Hampshire Now. 1059, 1450, and ConcordNewsRadio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program. We're about to head on the road in this hour of the show. So it's going to be a short journey over to the Pierce Manse here in Concord. WKXL On the Road, presented by Choices NH Addiction Recovery Services. Also by Paradigm Plumbing, Heating, Air Conditioning, the Spradling Group, Dennehy and Boulay. And we also want to thank the Greater Concord Chamber of Commerce. So we're going to learn about Franklin Pierce, who, of course, was the 14th President of the United States, here in just a few moments as we'll step inside the Pierce Manse. This hour of New Hampshire Now is brought to you by Orange Leaf Frozen Yogurt at 70 North Main Street in Concord. Convenient location for your next business meeting, offering 16 different flavors of frozen yogurt and smoothies in a relaxed environment. Orange Leaf at 70 North Main Street in Concord. And this segment of the show presented by P&N Automotive. I trust Chuck. He's the best in the capital region. I know it's so hard to find an honest garage. P&N Automotive, 140 Pleasant Street. Phone number 225-4313. Franklin Pierce ran for president in 1852. The differences in running for office and the highest office in the nation then as compared to now. It's going to be one of the focuses the next hour of the program as we head to the Pierce Manse in Concord. Up next, again, this hour of Hampshire Now, presented by Orange Leaf Frozen Yogurt, and that segment of the show presented by P&N Automotive.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now on WKXL.
Early in the morning, when the church bells toll, the choir's gonna sing, and the hearse will roll.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now.
So as a part of WKXL On the Road, we don't travel too far today, just down the road from our Concord Total Service Main Street studio to the Pierce Manse. We're joined by Joan Woodhead, who is the president of the Pierce Brigade, and we're going to be touring the manse today and talking a little bit about our nation's 14th president, who of course came from Concord, Hillsboro, the surrounding community of Concord, and made significant history in becoming president of the United States, and the process for becoming president was vastly different during that time period as compared to today. So we're going to talk about him, his accomplishments, and what you'll find here at the Pierce Manse, as we're honored to be joined by Joan Woodhead, as I mentioned, who is the president of the Pierce Brigade. Joan, thanks for having us.
Well, thank you very much for being here. It's always a pleasure to have people come and visit us.
So first off, I think that this is so important for students who are studying in school to take part in the political process and understanding the vast history here in New Hampshire. And I think that learning about Franklin Pierce, his service to our country, the process of which and how he became president, and really that time period, is so significant. We focus, I think, a lot of times on the World War II era, the Civil War era, and also the American Revolution era. But this was a important time period leading up to, obviously, the Emancipation Proclamation from Abraham Lincoln. So I think that this is a significant part of history, and there was a figure who came from Concord who had a significant role in that time period.
Yes, Franklin Pierce had been out of national politics for 10 years when the Democrats were meeting down in Baltimore. There were three candidates that were vying for the nomination. There was a lot of difficulty. They couldn't come to any conclusion, and so Virginia finally put Franklin Pierce's name up for nomination on the 35th ballot, and he was eventually nominated on the 49th ballot. So you can see from that process that there was a lot of disagreement, and a lot of people had different ideas about how the country should move forward. Pierce had been out of national politics for 10 years, having resigned a Senate seat in 1842 to come back to Concord to be with his young family and work on his law practice. He was always involved in the Democratic Party here in the state, so he was well known within the Democratic Party. And so he became their compromise candidate in 1852.
So what did a campaign for president look like in 1852? You mentioned, you know, the nominating process that took place, and that on the 32nd or 35th ballot, he was nominated by the Democratic Party to be president. So there was obviously no primary process that led up. We all know about the vast primary process which exists today and leads up to the convention, in which delegates are assigned to certain individuals based upon the votes received in the various primaries, which have all their own rules. So they came to the convention, and what was the campaigning like for Pierce, you know, in the convention? Did he go there with any intentions of being president? Was he there or even present at the time?
No, Pierce was not there when this process took place. His friends probably were working in the background for him, but he was riding with in a carriage south of Boston with his wife Jane when the messenger caught up to give him the news that he had been nominated. And Jane was extremely upset about that. She promptly fainted. That was the last thing she wanted, was for him to be involved in national politics and to go back to Washington. She did agree that he should run if that's what he felt he should do. He always had the interest of the country at heart. And so he agreed to be the nominee. And typically back then, it was ungentlemanly for the nominee to go out and campaign. And so Pierce went home, and he spent the time at home while his friends went out and campaigned. His vice presidential running mate was William Rufus Devane King, and he went out and did a lot of campaigning. He was a long-time friend of Buchanan, and was probably on the ballot to save a place in the next election cycle for Buchanan. So he did a lot of campaigning, and then after the 1852 election in October and the victory, he was not feeling well. So he went off to Cuba to try to recover his health. And then when it came time for the inauguration, King was still in Cuba, so Congress had to pass an act for him to take the oath of office on foreign soil. And that's the only time that has ever happened in our history. He did come back to this country 2 months after the inauguration, and unfortunately died 2 or 3 days later. So Pierce never had a vice president to work with, and there was nothing in the place at that time to put somebody into office. So he was kind of on his own down there.
One of the, you know, a couple of interesting things off of that. One, the fact that his wife fainted when she was informed that he was going to, you know, be the Democratic nominee for president. And, you know, whether it's the local level, and we talked earlier this week with David Booten, a Republican candidate for state Senate. He said, you know, the first foremost thing is you have to have the support of your family. If you don't have 100% support of your family, it's very difficult to run in a race and expend, you know, the 12, 15 hours a day, you know, to run for state Senate. Presidential candidate, same thing. They have to get full approval of their family. And if they don't have that, you know, they're not fully invested within the course of the campaign or doing the job. So I can only imagine, you know, how difficult it was, even though she eventually said yes, for him to feel that he had the buy-in, so to speak, of his wife and his family to go through this process. And, you know, from what I've read and know about Franklin Pierce, that moment was a moment that was very telling in how difficult it was going to be to manage the family side versus but in conjunction with the presidency moving forward.
Yes, Jane's family actually were Whigs, so their political views were very different. He and Jane got along well together and were always very loyal to each other, but they did have this difference in the political views from one family to the other. Eventually, when he was elected president, I think Jane's family came around and felt that maybe he was going to amount to something after all. They kind of doubted that, I think. They were married rather late for the time. She was 28 and he was 30. Jane's family really didn't approve of the Pierces. Her family was kind of the New England aristocracy. Mm-hmm. And Pierce's father, of course, ran a tavern in Hillsboro and was kind of a rough cut individual. But by the time they were married, his father had been governor of the state twice, and Pierce had was in the Senate. And so I think at this point they realized that probably he was going to amount to something.
That is Joan Woodhead joining us here on the Hampshire Now program as we are on the road today at the Pierce Manse in Concord. And we're going to hear more about the Pierce Manse and tour of the manse coming up just a little bit and some of the artifacts and things you'll learn about Franklin Pierce within this really amazing place right in our backyard here in Concord. I'm always curious about the campaign and the process side of things. So you referenced earlier the fact that Pierce did not really campaign for the presidency based upon the fact that it was not becoming to have the candidate out there pushing their message. So what did a campaign apparatus look like in 1852? How did they go about getting messaging out there? Was it via contacting newspapers, creating favorable relationships there? How did a voter in 1852 come to make the determination as to who they were going to vote for, and how would a campaign reach that voter?
Well, we obviously didn't have microphones like we do today, Chris. So Pierce's very good friend, Nathaniel Hawthorne, wrote a campaign biography. And this was one way people could find out about their candidates. They would hand out this biography, and people would have to read about the candidate. They also had token-type handouts. One would have a hole in it. They could pin this to their lapel to show who they were favoring as the candidate. This is the forerunner to the campaign buttons that we see mm-hmm. people wear today. Another campaign handout that's kind of interesting, and we have one upstairs in the gallery, is a pipe. And we were using a lot of tobacco back then, and this was a favorite handout. It was Pierce's head as the bowl of the pipe. And so his friends would go around and they would have meetings. The newspapers would cover the meetings, and so people would be able to read about the candidates in their newspapers. Sometimes they would have gatherings. There was a big barbecue in Hillsboro that was very well attended. There were trainloads of people coming up from Boston and over from the coast. They had a big roasting pit over there, which has the stones have been put back together. It's right on the river there, and so they've been able to find the stones and kind of recreate that pit. But that probably was attended by something like 5,000 people, which you can imagine was a lot at that time. And they would have people coming from all over to speak to them, and it was quite a festive occasion. I think they had a big oxen that they were roasting in this oven over there, and so it was that was one way people found out about the candidate. Pierce, I don't believe, was at the barbecue. Some of his family members were there, and his friends and so forth were there to speak to the crowd that had accumulated in Hillsboro for this event.
So why did he win the presidency in 1852? How was he able to connect with the electorate across the country. What was the driving rationale for why he was elected president?
He was running against Winfield Scott, who was the candidate for the Whigs, and he had fought under Winfield Scott in the Mexican War. Winfield Scott was older than Pierce, called him Old Fuss and Feathers, so he wasn't a real popular individual. As time went on through the campaign, he realized he was falling behind, and so he did go out and campaign.
Just one sec. Who was that? You mentioned they called him Old Fuss and Feathers. Was it the campaign? Did Pierce's campaign label him that, or is that something that...
A nickname that he just acquired somewhere along the way. Okay. So he was just generally known in the public as Old Fuss and Feathers. But as the campaign went on, he was falling behind, and so he did go out and campaign on his own, and that was kind of the killing blow to his candidacy. People just didn't approve of the candidates going out, and I guess it was seen as bragging about yourself, and so they really kind of turned against him, and then Pierce won the election by quite a margin of electoral votes.
That's one of the more remarkable things that we're going to talk about today is the difference in a campaign in 1852 as compared to, 2016 or 18 or 20, where, the politician is expected to do just about everything in order to achieve the office. And they're going to be out there. They're going to talk about themselves. They're going to label their accomplishments. They're going to take credit for things that they had, perhaps nothing to do with, or very limited amounts of things to do with, in order to bolster that resume. But Old Fuss and Feathers ended up losing the election based upon the fact that in your view that he went out and campaigned. And also, but one thing that's very similar is that, you have a young, vibrant individual in Franklin Pierce, and, he is able to push forth that type of a narrative, and you have a individual who has a nickname, which I would assume, given the amount of limited information that took place, that was dispersed in that time period, it was nearly impossible to shake that nickname. And once you have a nickname like that, I don't know how you overcome that, because you can't really, compensate. And I can understand, certainly his, willingness to get out there on the campaign trail and try to change, the narrative that I'm old and irreverent, and I'm going to take the country in a direction that brings it, back towards the past instead of towards the future. And naturally, as a candidate or a human, you want to try to change that that narrative.
That's true. He just couldn't ever come over that Fuss and Feathers nickname. And you see pictures of them, there's lithographs that are similar of both men on horseback in the Mexican War that were printed in 1852, because the military service was good on your resume back then also. And there's quite a difference in the appearance in the lithograph between Pierce and Winfield Scott.
And that's very similar to today, where, obviously the methods of connecting an individual, with a candidate, it gets back to the televised debate between Nixon and Kennedy, where they heard them, and if you heard the debate, you may have thought differently than if you saw them. And a depiction of an individual, still creates an element of commonality. You can look at them and say, this person seems like me, or they seem like a person who's vibrant and young and going to bring the country in the right direction, or somebody who, is perhaps above everybody else and is not able to appeal to the plight of the common businessman or the common man. So there's things that are similar, obviously, but just a vastly different method of determining a presidential candidate. I'm not sure if you're going to know this offhand, but it's curious as to, you know, what voter turnout was like in the 1852 election. We saw, you know, in this past election, about roughly 45% of registered voters chose not to vote. What was participation like, particularly given the fact that you know, there was not really the ability to feel like you had a connection for, or in some cases, more importantly, against a candidate in the current time period?
Well, I'm not sure what the percentage was of people voting. Of course, we had a lot less people back then. Right. And without the technology, you didn't get the instantaneous results coming. It took days for them to figure out who actually had won the election. So it was quite a different time. I would imagine that at this point, it wasn't that long ago that our country had fought for the freedom and the right to vote, and I would imagine voter turnout probably reflected that feeling that this was a privilege and a responsibility for them to get out and choose a candidate. And so I would imagine it probably would have been a pretty good voter turnout, particularly if there was quite a competition between the two candidates.
That is Joan Woodhead joining us here at the Pierce Manch. She's the president of the Pierce Brigade. And after the break, we're going to head out into the Pierce Manse and look at some of the more interesting artifacts and discuss a little more about Pierce's life and his service in the military as also and also as president of the United States. But one of the things that I talk about a lot on the show is when you know, President Clinton came here to the Pierce Manse in 2009. And it was so intriguing to hear him speak about Pierce's legacy, what Pierce must have been thinking during certain times of his presidency, the tragedy that he dealt with, which we haven't gotten to yet, but will in regards to his son who died in a train crash, and we'll get to that when we move on with the tour. But, you know, if you look at surveys of presidents, Pierce is generally regarded as one of the worst presidents, quote unquote, in our country's history. And Clinton made the argument that that is not fair, and that he was the best president that he could be given the circumstances and the time that our nation was in at that point, that we were not ready for, in his view, emancipation. And that that Pierce, in fact, did what he could to keep the Union together and to hold the Union during that time period. But, you know, it would appear that President Pierce and the Pierce Brigade has always kind of struggled with the narrative of him being not a good president, and that has created challenges. So I'm curious from your perspective, you know, A, how do you view Pierce's presidency in context, and B, you know, it seems that there's not that connection that there should be between the people of New Hampshire and Franklin Pierce.
That's very true. Pierce did accomplish quite a few things. That we have a pamphlet that we hand to people, the myths and truth about the Pierce presidency. He reduced the national debt by 60%. We could use somebody that might be able to do that today. He had treaties that he did with Canada and Great Britain on fishing rights and so forth. He opened trade with Japan on the return of Admiral Perry. And he also pushed through the Gadsden Purchase, which drew the border line between Mexico and the United States. So there were a lot of good things that happened during Pierce's time. Unfortunately, the thing that really brought him down was the Kansas-Nebraska mm-hmm. Act, which was one of Senator Douglas's bills that he was encouraged to sign. And of course, this is a very down period during his lifetime, and so I think that he had no idea what the result was going to be. You spoke about President Clinton being here, and I remember him talking about him signing that bill and saying that he had the information that he had was the best that he had at the time, and that's what he used to make that decision. And you don't always know what the outcome is going to be. And so this is the way we think about President Pierce. He used the best information that he had, and nobody can see into the future what the results of some of these actions are going to be.
Yeah, and I agree. And obviously, you know, in retrospect, it was not a good decision. But at the time period, as President Clinton mentioned and you referenced and I referenced earlier, it was also a question of was the nation, you know, ready to pick up arms and to fight for the freedom of slaves and to do what was right at that moment. And we see, you know, throughout the course of history that you know, whether it's during that time period or other time periods, you know, the American people and particularly the politicians are, you know, behind what is right for that time period, but are focused more on, you know, what is achievable. And I know I talk a lot on the program about the need for, you know, common sense conclusions and bipartisanship and all those things, because that's what's achievable in the moment. And then you work towards your greater goals. And the Kansas-Nebraska Act was, in my view, Pierce pushed that, signed that legislation because of the fact that you know, he didn't know if the nation was ready, or and that seemed to be what President Clinton was extolling as well, for the ramifications of emancipation. In other words, he was trying to keep the nation together at that point by not doing what was morally courageous and what was appropriate, but by what was the necessity of that particular moment.
Well, Jefferson Davis was his Secretary of War, and he modernized the Army and the Navy. And I had read that if we had gone to war during Pierce's time, the outcome could have been quite a bit different than it was today. The North may not have been ready to go to war with the troops and the equipment that a modern Army and Navy would gave them the advantage.
Right. So there's the military aspect, and there's also, you know, the will of the nation and trying to determine if they were ready. So, yeah, I mean, this is something we could talk about for hours, but we're not going to. We're going to go upstairs and tour some of the aspects of the Pierce Manse which are most intriguing. That is Joan Woodhead. She is the president of the Pierce Brigade. I am Chris Ryan. It's WKXL On the Road at the Pierce Manse today, and we'll come back with more after this.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now.
Well, I can stand beside ideals I think are right, and I can stand beside the idea to stand and fight. I do believe there's a dream for everyone. This is our country. There's room enough here for science to live, and there's room enough here for religion to forgive and try to understand.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now.
Continue at the Pierce Manse at WKXL On the Road as we're joined by Joan Woodhead, who is the president of the Pierce Brigade. Let's talk a little bit about the history of the Pierce Manse and the Pierce's history at the Pierce Manse, and also the move of the Pierce Manse, as it does have a pretty extensive history.
It does. The Pierces lived in this house from 1842 to 1848. Pierce resigned a Senate seat to come back and move into the house with his wife Jane and two sons, Frankie and Benny. And they had two Irish girls that lived here with them, one to take care of the children and the other one to help with the household chores and the cooking. And so that was the family that moved into the manse in 1842. In 1848, the house was sold. They lost their second son, Frankie, who died of typhus in this house. And Pierce went off to the Mexican War in 1847. When he returned in 1848, he sold the house. And from that point on, the Pierces never really owned anything. They either rented or stayed with relatives or lived in boarding houses. So their life changed quite a bit, and there was a lot of tragedy in their life. I think when they moved in 1842, it was probably one of the happiest times during their life. They had their two sons, and he was back from Washington. He wasn't in national politics anymore, so that made Jane happy. So I think it was one of the more comfortable and happy times that they had during their lifetime.
So what's the the Pierce manse is different, obviously, than the Pierce homestead in Hillsboro. What's the difference? That's where Franklin Pierce was born, and where his father had the tavern that you referenced before.
That's right. The homestead belonged to Benjamin Pierce, and this is the boyhood home of Franklin Pierce. His father took him to Bowdoin College when he was 16, and so that's when he left the house, and he went to college and then studied law and opened a law office over there. So he had lived over there during his boyhood and then young adulthood after returning from college while he was studying law.
So they lived in different different places after the White House?
After the White House, they came back to Concord, and while Pierce was president, he had loaned money to William Willard to build a house down on South Main Street, with the understanding that he would keep the rooms at the front of the house for the Pierces to return to whenever they were traveling. And so this was where they lived. This was their address after they left the presidency. It wasn't too long after they were through in Washington that they took a two-year tour to Europe to try to recover Jane's health. She was always very frail. She was about 100 pounds. Her father had died of consumption. She probably suffered from that also.
What is that, consumption?
Well, it would be like TB today or chest ailments anyway. So
you hear that and you're like, they died of like overeating or something. And
right. They have some different names for things like dropsy and things like that for cirrhosis of the liver that we would call it today. So we do have some different ailments that we hear them speak about during that time. We think she also suffered from depression, because in any of the correspondence in the family, they talk about her, how she's feeling, whether she's doing well or not, whether she's happy. We're hoping she's feeling better, and this is just kind of an ongoing thing through all the correspondence and in all the family letters. So we can treat depression today, but they couldn't back then, and so she probably suffered from that also.
How about him? How did he cope with, having to deal with her? And her depression, the loss of his children, the burdens of the nation. And as you referenced, he became really besieged during his time in office with the weight and also everything that was going on in his life.
Pierce was a very charismatic gentleman. He and Jane were totally opposites personality-wise. Somebody asked Pierce one time why he had ever married his wife, Jane, and his response was, "Who could take better care of her than I?" So he had a very empathetic, sympathetic personality. He was a lawyer for the Shakers when there was a court to get rid of them up in Canterbury. The case was thrown out. He also helped the Catholics come into Concord and get settled. By going to Father Barry and befriending him, he drew him into the social fabric of the city, and within 2 years he'd raised enough money to build the Catholic Church down on South Main Street, St. John's.
And the parish hall is named after Father Barry there currently.
Oh, I didn't realize that, so that's good to know. So he always was looking out for people. His good friend, Nathaniel Hawthorne, who wrote the campaign biography, also needed help finding jobs from time to time, and this was an ongoing thing throughout their lifetime, was to have Pierce and his friends looking for work for Nathaniel Hawthorne. So he, when he was president, he appointed him to be the envoy to the embassy in Liverpool, England, for the 4 years that he was in office. When, excuse me, when Hawthorne died, he was with Pierce up in the Pemigewasset Inn in Plymouth, New Hampshire. And Pierce educated Hawthorne's children, gave money to his wife, Sophia, and helped to educate a lot of his nieces and nephews. So you can see that he had a very empathetic personality.
All right, so final thing, let's talk a little about the, in this particular room, let's talk a little about what we'll find here and some of the artifacts. I see a top hat in front of me. It looks like a cane as well, and I assume that they belong to Franklin Pierce. The hat looks kind of small. How big was Pierce?
I would say he was probably under 6 feet. We don't know for sure. But I'm guessing that would be about his height. And of course, the top hat would sit on the top of your head, so it didn't pull down over your ears or anything. You'd want it to be kind of sitting on top of your head. So it probably is a little bit, I don't know, size-wise, what size it is, actually.
And in terms of the cane that's here?
The cane... is a walking stick, and men dressed very formally back then. They always wore the top hat. You can see this one has a little wear on the brim because they'd walk down the street and tip their hats to people as they walked along. The walking stick, he's one of several that he owned. It has an ivory head with a silver band around it that says General Frank Pierce. It's a little bit shorter than it was when Pierce used it. Most of the things that we have at the manse came from two grandnieces who were living in 1974 when the manse opened. They were in their 90s, and they were looking for places for these things to go, and we were happy to purchase from them or accept any of them as gifts. One of them needed the cane, so they used what they had, and they've cut the tip of this one off. It probably was 2 or 3 inches longer with a brass tip on the end of it, but it was used by one of the nieces when she got a little older and needed a little help to get around.
So let's take a walk into the parlor now, where I understand we're going to find some of the furniture in here that President Pierce had while he was in the White House.
In this room, we have Jane's sofa over here. And when Jane died in 1863, Pierce gave that to her sister. And when the house opened in 1974, the sister's family returned the sofa to the manse for us to use here, along with the table in the center of the room, which was known in their family as the White House table. So evidently they were borrowing furniture from family and friends to furnish the 8 rooms in the White House that were for their personal use. Another piece that belonged to the Pierces that went to the White House is the little writing table and chair here. And Pierce would be up till 3 o'clock in the morning answering letters and writing speeches sitting at this little writing desk here. And under the glass is a piece of the White House stationery with Pierce's family coat of arms at the top of the sheet.
Yeah, it is remarkable how small that the desk is, as you referenced before. I mean, you think of, you know, a big, huge desk that a president would use, but this desk, you know, is barely room for, you know, both your elbows to sit on it, and has a light fixture as well. And that's, you know, important thing to remember as well, that there was not electricity during that time period, and you had to use other methods to gain light.
That's right. Candles and lamps were the order of the day here. So, you'd have the little desk, the little ink blotter there, probably a pen and an inkwell there. And they didn't have paper like we do today, an overabundance of it. So I guess you didn't need a huge surface. You couldn't pile up a whole lot of paper the way we can do today.
And so, as you mentioned, you would find this stuff on, if you were looking at the White House from the front entrance, you would find it on the second floor, which is the president's living quarters. And the furniture that is in the public areas, the White House is kept there. But the president, each president moves in and out with their own furniture in the public living space. So there's once that time period is their time period of their presidency is up, they have to bring that home. So that's all. This furniture all comes from the public space. The private space upstairs.
That's right. This would belong to them, and these were the pieces that they took to the White House with them. They also owned the bookcase that's in the corner there, and that stood right in that corner when they lived here in the house. So it's kind of an interesting piece with the curtain hanging over the front to keep the dust off the books.
Couple pictures on the wall here in the parlor. One is of Franklin Pierce, and there's another picture over the fireplace. So who is that?
The picture over the fireplace is Benjamin Pierce, and this is Franklin Pierce's father. So he fought in the Revolutionary War with George Washington. He was an orphan down in Chelmsford, Mass. When he heard about the guns going off in Lexington, so he dropped his plow and followed the troops into Boston, fought at Bunker Hill, and then he stayed with Washington right till the end of the war, at which time he came up to Hillsboro and bought the land out there. So Pierce was born in a log cabin, which is now at the bottom of Lake Pierce due to flood control. And then before he was a year old, his father moved the family into the big Georgian mansion over in Hillsboro where he grew up.
We can move upstairs now, and I was interested in talking a little bit more about Franklin Pierce's service, and you talked about his dad before. And how would you categorize first the relationship between, you know, Pierce and his dad? As you mentioned before, there was some friction between Jane, his wife's family, and the Pierces based upon the fact that he had fought his way up. He was a true working person who had fought himself up from being an orphan to, you know, governor of the state of New Hampshire. How did that affect, if at all, the relationship between Franklin Pierce and his dad, Benjamin?
Franklin and Benjamin, I would say, were pretty close. Benjamin was always involved in politics. After he came up and built the house there, he was sheriff of the county, moderator of the town. He represented Hillsboro in the legislature for many years, and then, of course, was governor of the state for two terms. So Pierce followed his father into footsteps, in his father's footsteps, and he ran for the legislature when he was 23. And was elected, and then by the time he was 26, he was the Speaker of the House of Representatives here in Concord. That's the youngest speaker we've ever had. So I think he admired his father's politics and the way his father kind of watched out for people. He had that same kind of caring attitude for the common man, I think, and this is where Pierce picked this up. Or Franklin picked this up from his father, I think. So I think he admired his father because he really had nothing when he started out, and he was a self-made man.
You referenced a couple of times the service of Franklin Pierce in the Mexican-American War. And, of course, that time period coincided with his residence here. What can you tell us a little more about his service, how he was viewed by, both his subordinates and his superiors during his service in the Mexican-American War?
Okay, Pierce was in the militia. He was a citizen soldier, I guess you would say. President Polk asked Pierce to raise troops for the Mexican War, which he did. He raised 1,000 troops. They made him a brigadier general. They went down to Newport, Rhode Island, boarded sailing vessels, to head for Mexico. The wind died down. They bounced around for about a month out on the Atlantic Ocean before it finally came up again. And then he made it to Veracruz, and they fought in a couple of the battles there. He was wounded and fell off his horse, I believe. And so a lot of times people that were derogatory would reference that and say that he fainted. during the war, but he did get back on his horse, even though he was wounded. He led his men into battle. And so I think that his troops really had a lot of respect for him, and some of the other generals that fought with him looked upon him very highly during that time.
All right, as I mentioned, we have come upstairs now. Tell us a little about the room we find ourselves in.
This would have been used as a guest room during the Pierce's time. People traveled a long way and would come and visit for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. So they would try to give them a good room where they had enough a room they could get away from the family and have a little privacy. They could have had tea or coffee served in the room here, but it was important for them to have a place that they could retreat to and spend a little time away from the family if they wanted to do that.
I also see a picture over the furnace here. Who's that?
This is the youngest son, Benjamin, and you'll notice that the picture is very dark. Benny was killed tragically in a train accident down in Andover, Massachusetts, in January of 1853. They were returning from Andover after the holidays, and the car they were riding in was a very flimsy affair that was made out of wood and canvas. The axle broke, and it turned around on the track and rolled down an embankment. Benny was the only fatality, and he was killed in front of his parents, both parents. So this was a terrible tragedy. This was their last living son, and Jane never really recovered from this. So Franklin was left with trying to handle his own grief, support his wife through this terrible situation, and then think about going down to lead the country in a couple of months for the inauguration in March. He would have to take on the responsibility of being the President of the United States.
And, you know, it's been described that Pierce's presidency was, you know, beset with tragedy. As you mentioned, he had another son that died previous. And it is very eerie looking at that picture because it's extremely dark in the backdrop. He's wearing a dark shirt and button up and a white collar, and you just see the face. That's a very, very eerie picture. It seems like that was kind of a theme for Pierce, was trying to overcome various challenges and tragedies. Is that the way you see it as well?
I think he had a lot of tragedy in their lifetime. People at that time lost children. It wasn't an unusual thing, but for Franklin and Jane, they lost all three of theirs, so they had no family left. And this picture of Benny is dark, so it was probably painted after he was killed, and that's why it is painted in such a dim fashion. They used a little daguerreotype that we have downstairs in the gallery that's about the size of a quarter. And if you look at the daguerreotype, you see the clothing is the same as what we see in the picture here in this room.
And his bed is also in this room, correct?
Yes, the little bed that we see here has been lengthened to fit an adult and refinished, but this was Benny's bed. And after Benny was killed, Jane wrote a letter to her son, Benny, talking about the little bed you love so well. And so this is the bed that she's referring to, the one that we have here in the guest room. They would have had a double bed in this room when they used it for the guests.
Well, we certainly invite all of our listeners, as well as individuals who listen to us across the country and the state, to come to the Pierce Manse. I always enjoy going to presidential homes and libraries, whether it's Calvin Coolidge, Chester A. Arthur, Grover Cleveland, or Franklin Pierce, or Teddy Roosevelt, as you see the wide spectrum of presidential lives. And this is a special place for Concord and for the state of New Hampshire. And as I've said before, I think, you know, we should be proud and get further understanding in regards to Franklin Pierce's presidency. We want to thank you for having us.
Well, we're very glad to have you come, and we'll be glad to welcome anybody who'd like to come and visit and learn a little bit more about Franklin Pierce and New Hampshire history.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now.
And if the darkness is to keep us apart.